There's an old saying that goes, if you can remember the 60s, you weren't there. Well, I've got only the sketchiest memories of the 60s. But that's mainly because I was in kindy when it ended. But Nolene Brown remembers it very, very well. And she says it was the most important decade of her life. Nolene Brown began the 60s as a librarian in a working class suburb of Sydney. And she ended it as one of the most popular TV comedians and actors in Australia. Nolene remembers the 60s as a decade of safari suits, shift dresses, capri pants and droopy moustaches. And also of anti-war protests, of rock and roll, devils on horseback and Bloody Marys. And she'd be hard-pressed to say which of those things she liked the most. In subsequent decades, Nolene Brown would go on to star in The Naked Vicar Show. She stood for Parliament twice and was appointed Australia's first ambassador for ageing. But it was in the 60s that Nolene jumped out of Australia's brand new TV sets in the infamous series The Mavis Bramston Show. Nolene Brown has written a beautiful new book for the National Library of Australia, and it's called Living in the 1960s. Welcome back, Nolene. How lovely to see you.
It's beautiful to see you too, Richard.
There's the most gorgeous pic of you inside the front cover of this picture book. And you're quite young. You're sitting on a jetty and you're holding an umbrella and smiling and looking up towards the sky. What's going on in that picture? And do you remember that day it was taken?
I do remember the day. It was a page 3 photograph for The Sun or some newspaper like that. Usually, I think people were topless, but I was allowed to keep my top on, maybe because it was quite a cold day and wet, but I do remember it, and I was quite pleased because I didn't have to take my top off, but some of those photographers were very keen to get you to do so.
God, on a cold and blustery day, it would have been a bit much, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
When the 60s started, like I said, you were a teenage librarian. What do you remember of that life?
I loved my job in the library. It was a fantastic thing. And I wasn't really a librarian. I always say I was a fake one. I was a library assistant because I went for a job as an assistant librarian. I didn't have the leaving. So they said, oh, we can give you a job as a library assistant. And I thought, well, that's close enough. So at 15 years of age, I went off to work full time at Marrickville Library. And it was the beginning of my life because it opened up the world to me because Marrickville Library University, I believe.
All right, so you were using it as an opportunity to read books and broaden your mind a bit.
I was, and I had a really good person who was a mentor to me who really understood that I had an interest in the arts because I could paint and draw a little bit, but she told me to go and see the local theatre, which was called the Pocket Playhouse, and it was a terrific little theatre. It only held 70 people, used to do shows for kids in the afternoon and shows for adults at night. And I was lucky enough to be cast in a lead role, which got the attention of the major critics. And that was the beginning of my career.
Was it hard to muster up the courage to audition for the stage for the first time, Nolene?
No, it wasn't. I was blissfully ignorant. I thought it would be an exciting thing to do. I had actually been in a musical where I had to walk downstairs semi-undressed, like in underwear, which I found awful. It was a review for the Petersham Musical Society.
And I thought, pretty saucy for the Petersham Musical Society.
Well, it was. I mean, it was no more saucy than the swimsuit that I would have worn happily at the beach. It was like, you know, the waist of the pants came right up to my waist. But I just felt really exposed and I felt it was unnecessary. So when I was given a job speaking words, I really liked that.
Did your mum come and see you perform on stage? What did they think of
it? My whole family came to
really?
See me. Yes, yes, very much so. My dad particularly was always excited when I got a new part. He wasn't always around because he worked away from home on the trains delivering mail. So whenever he could, he'd come and see our shows. And if, you know, if I did a show in Melbourne or Newcastle later on, Dad would go there as well. And occasionally would turn around if somebody laughed and say, that's my daughter.
Oh, that's lovely.
That's
fabulous. Putting aside appearances on stage in heavily reinforced knickers, Australia was still a very conservative place in the early 60s, wasn't it, Nolene?
It was. It was extremely conservative. And the whole political landscape made it even more conservative because the Liberals had been in all my life, it seemed to me. And I, of course, came from a blue-collar background, so Dad was very much a labour man, and he thought that Menzies had been there long enough. He felt that Menzies was born to rule, so I probably inherited a bit of that from Dad.
I think that in the immediate post-war years, after all that upheaval of the war itself, led people to want a pretty quiet life in suburban Australia. But was it the 60s when that started to break?
There was so much more that happened for women, and I think that changed everything. I mean, during the war, women did work because they were taking over the jobs of men. But then when the men came back from the war, it was very much going back to the kitchen and doing all that stuff that a lot of them didn't really want to do that. They liked the independence. They liked earning their own money, not being dependent on a male to support them. So I think that they really resented the fact that they didn't have their jobs anymore. And then when the pill came, that was the beginning of the end for that sort of attitude, because you could choose. You could choose whether you were going to have children. When I was a kid, the girls I grew up with married at 21. If they, you know, that's quite old in those days to get married, and probably went to the marriage bed a virgin. Well, I thought when the pill came out, that doesn't have to happen. So I was one of the first to go to the doctor and say, I'd like to go on the pill, please.
How did you hear about it? Was it a word-of-mouth thing, or was it in all the magazines?
It got a lot of publicity. Newspapers were full of it. You know, the pill was going to bring down the world as we knew it. Women were going to not marry at all and all of this stuff.
Did you get a stern lecture from the doctor when you asked for the pill, or was the doctor all right about it?
The doctor was okay, because I checked that he wasn't a Catholic, because a Catholic doctor would not have allowed me to have. But I did have to lie and say I was getting married. Well, it wasn't a lie, because I knew I'd get married one day.
And you did.
Yes, and I did. It took me a while. So we had to go to the chemist a long way from where we lived, so they wouldn't know that you were on the pill. The doctor handed me the prescription and said, congratulations.
Where did you live in those days?
Well, I lived at home for a long time, but when I really got into acting full-time and was working in television, I thought it only fair that I should go flatting. And, of course, you went to the Cross. And the Cross in those days was the most charming village, with lots of European, elderly European people, wonderful shops, the butcher, the fishmonger, the greengrocer, and they all knew you and looked after you. Sure, there were some ladies of the night around, but there was no sort of drug-addled crazies hanging around like now.
It was before the tragedy of heroin, wasn't it?
It was before R&R. That's what wrecked the Cross. It was a beautiful, beautiful place. So I had a little flat there. Then I got a bigger flat, and I was very much a local.
How were you tapped to become part of the cast of the Mavis Bramston show?
Totally by accident, and a lot of things in my life have been by accident, Richard. Barry Creighton was in the show, and he and I had worked together in the first review that we both did together, which was called What's New. And oddly enough, the program looks very like the cover of this book, The Living in the 1960s, very much the same colour scheme and whatever.
Like a Marimekko print or something.
Yes, very much so. So Barry Creighton and I went to a party for the Mavis Bramston show writers and producers, and Barry was cast in it with Carol Rae and Gordon Chater. And they were talking about, the lead writer was saying, we should be taking the piss out of imported stars, because that's all we do, play second fiddle to someone from overseas who may not be very good at it anyway. So this woman should be called Mavis Bramston, and she should have no talent at all. She can't sing, she can't dance, she can't play the piano, she can't tell a joke. And somebody said, why are you calling it Mavis Bramston? Now, this is my version, there are others. And he said, I was on a plane coming back from Melbourne once, and this air hostess, as they called them then, was rude to me, and her name was Mavis Branston. So it was a writer getting his own back. So then they said, well, we've got to get someone. We can't have someone from overseas doing it. It's got to be local. And then they all looked at me because I'd just started in show business. I've been in it for about a year, and I hadn't really been on telly much, so nobody really knew me, knew my face. So they said, you can do it. Oh, I said, oh, thanks very much. Can't sing, can't dance, can't whatever. I certainly can't play the piano. So they said, we'll disguise you, don't worry, it'll only be one show. You'll be on the show, you'll be really bad, you'll have to sing and be interviewed, and then we'll put you on a plane back to England and we will do the show. I thought, oh, okay. But I didn't think it would really get off the air because they were getting into politics, they were taking the piss out of politicians and people with money and captains of industry. So I didn't think that it would get off the air, but it ran for, I don't know, was it 8 years?
8 years. That's amazing. This is from the theme song from the very first episode of the Mavis Branston Show, beginning with a very smartly dressed Gordon, in very camp, Gordon Chater, right at the start, leering at the audience, 9 p.m. at night.
Are the kiddies in bed? Good.
Welcome, welcome, welcome. How do you do? Hello. Come to your block. It's 9 o'clock. It's the Mavis Branston Show. We'll have no vows, no sacred. Unhurting is our need. We'll sing to you and bring to you the view of the man in the street.
Isn't that great? We'll sing to you and bring to you the view of the man on the street.
And they're all there in their stovepipe pants and their winkle pickers and hilarious.
Everyone looks like they're in the cast of Mad Men in that.
Well, they do. Yeah. Well, that's where they got those suits from, of course. That's about that time. Hilarious.
And this is, I suppose, taking its cues from the satire boom that was happening at the same time in London with Peter Cook and Dudley Moore.
But it also came from the Phillip Street Theatre, which was doing satire on stage, and that's where Barry and I had first worked together.
So very soon, you would have gone then, Nolene, and I don't know if people really fully get this today. In an age when there were just, what, four TV stations, there was 7, 9, and I think Channel 10 was around.
I don't think we had.
You didn't even have 10 then?
I don't think so.
So it would have been 3 then.
The 729 Club was where we all went, so it wasn't called the 7290 Club.
Oh, right, so there's just 3
yes.
then. 7,
I'm
9
sure.
and the ABC.
Yeah.
And when you suddenly go on a national TV show in an era like the 1960s,
yes.
you suddenly go from being perfectly anonymous to being massively famous in
Hugely,
Australia.
Yes.
Did that discombobulate you a bit, walking out the street and having everyone recoil and react and run up to you or walk away?
It was quite difficult, I have to say. Now, of course, looking back on it, I wish I'd been more gracious, but sometimes people weren't gracious. They'd grab a biro and stick it into your chest and say, here, sign this, or, you know, but mostly I found it difficult. And Barry Creighton and I had been friends for years and years and years. And the press wanted us to be lovers so much that there was a helicopter hovering over our verandas. Not that we lived together. We lived in the same block of flats, but two floors between us.
Who sent a helicopter to see if you
were... I don't know, but there was
TV Week or something? I don't know.
It was a newspaper. It was a woman journalist who was up there trying to get shots of us doing things to each other. Well, with two floors between them, made it a bit difficult.
So this was a TV show that was conceived around the whole idea of what was then known and still known as Australia's cultural cringe, the idea that they do it better elsewhere, they do it better outside of Australia. How bad do you remember it being in the early 60s?
Pretty awful. The funny thing about that cultural cringe with that particular show was they kept the Mavis Branston character to do the commercials, and then eventually imported stars to be the leads in the show. So it was crazy. But the cultural cringe, I think, still exists. I think there is still that thing of, you had to go overseas to prove your worth, and I think you still do. I went overseas for a year. I got so lonely. I missed Australia so much. I had, you know, a wide circle of friends and family, very close family, and I used to follow Australians. I could hear their voices, follow them just to listen to them talk. And I thought, oh, I think I probably have to go home now. So I was invited to come back into the cast of the Mavis Bramston show as myself. So very happy to do so.
You went from there to be in a sitcom called My Name's Magooly, What's Yours, with John Mellion was in that?
John Mellion, Gordon Chater again and right. Judy Farr were the main characters.
I went back and looked at a couple of eps that are floating around on YouTube, and there's some pretty amazing lines in some of the scripts you've got there. This is you interacting with John Mellion.
Tell you what, it wouldn't do you any harm to read this book either, Possum.
What is it?
Book about etiquette.
Oh, very up to date. Published by Kernew and Felby, 1907. Oh, in society, it is polite to call the limb the extremity. The word leg is considered vulgar. That'd sound great at the drive-in, wouldn't it? Hey, Fred, would you mind getting your extremity out of the small of my back and sticking it in the glove box?
I have no memory of that at all.
Hey, Fred, would you mind getting your extremity out of the small of my back and sticking it in the glove box?
Pretty rude.
Pretty amazing, but I suppose it would have sailed over the top of a lot of people's heads back in then, wouldn't it? Or maybe not, I don't know.
I think they liked a bit of naughty stuff, but that was particularly unusual. So much so I have no memory of it at all. Sounds more like the Naked Vicar show a few years later.
It seems to anticipate that. Yeah. How about the ABC in those days? Was it much chop in those days, Nolene, or was it a bit like an overseas branch of the BBC?
It was different from the commercial stations. Everybody was sort of friendlier. It was not like a sheltered workshop, but maybe a bit.
With people with British accents, yeah.
A lot.
More like, here's the news, wasn't it?
Yes, there are lots of hyphens. Yes, but we did have some very, very dear friends in the ABC who were very helpful to us later on as we were doing The Naked Vicar in the 70s. So we did have some very good people at the ABC, but most of our work was done with the commercial channels.
Well, this was a time when the cultural cringe was being pushed to one side. On the one hand, you had the Mavis Bramston show, Australia's proper first satirical TV show, and TV dramas like Homicide. What was the effect on Australians seeing other Australians on screen doing this kind of thing, presenting their stories, I suppose, or strange versions of their stories on the small screen?
I think they liked it a lot. I think they took a while to accept them, because I certainly remember a cousin of mine ringing up and saying, "Oh, Nolene, I heard you in that show," and she said, "No one talks like that." So I think there was a bit of that. We still like the ABC pronunciation. And I think that, you know, hearing their own voices took a while for them to actually accept. And, of course, the Mavis Bramston show was done by Carol Rae, English, Gordon Chater, English, and Barry Creighton, who wanted to be English.
Houses were so different. Houses changed enormously in this period. Years ago, I went out to, I was in Bathurst, and I thought I'll have a look at Ben Chifley's house, the former Prime Minister's house. And it's kept in its kind of old wartime years condition. And what you're going to a very small worker's house with a lot of overstuffed furniture, everything all crowded in, and slightly claustrophobic and almost mausoleum-like, I think maybe the houses were in those days. And then in the 60s, it's more like Rose Sidler House. You get these bungalows with light and air and that amazing sort of Scandinavian furniture. Did you have a similar transition like that from those kind of houses?
Yes, I was probably almost engaged. Yeah, I was engaged, let's face it. I was certainly engaged once. And my boyfriend and I were very keen on modern contemporary design. So even though we loved, you know, really old houses and we supported heritage listed stuff and went on a few demos to keep them going and whatever, but we loved Pettit and Sevett and designers like that, architects who built houses where they opened them up. The kitchen was still separate, but there was a sort of open plan living and dining area. The car wasn't so important. They had a carport. Mm. And in fact, there were two bathrooms in a Pettit and Severed house. How about that?
I know. Think of how many marriages that saved, just alone having two bathrooms in the same house.
Indeed.
I think those post-war modernist Australian houses, you see them in Brisbane, suburbs of Brisbane, you see them in the north, northern suburbs of Sydney, and in Hobart as well. I think they're timelessly chic, those things.
They are.
Are they having a bit of a resurgence nowadays, aren't
they? They very much are, and so is the furniture that went into them. I just wish I hadn't thrown or got rid of all the furniture that my mum and dad had by the time they died, because it was that sort of furniture, the Parker and whatever, sleek-looking timber framed furniture, lightweight. Now it's back and it's hugely expensive.
Wiping up, wiping up. I've had it.
Ah, yes, with Trix it's a different matter. There's no wiping up problems with Trix in the house. The wife washes and the dishes dry themselves. And see how easily Trix removes dirt.
There was a huge thing going on in the kitchen at the same time in the 1960s in Australia, the introduction of small appliances. I suppose they were greeted with the same enthusiasm that a new iPhone update might have these days. You know, the introduction of a fridge, replacing the icebox and the meat safe, Mixmasters.
Gadgets.
Gadgets,
yeah. We had a lot of gadgets. My mum was very, very keen to adopt any new gadget. The fridge we'd had for quite a long time, she was an early adopter of that as well. But I certainly remember the Iceman cometh.
No wonder your mum was dead keen on these new devices, because they saved women particularly so much backbreaking labour, particularly the washing machine. The introduction of the washing machine is apart from the old mangle that women used to have to use.
Washing machine, fantastic. Because I remember those Mondays. For some reason, it was always on a Monday. Yeah. We would have had a copper.
What was that? Was that a tub of some
it
kind?
It was a tub, and it would have been made of copper. And there was a lot of stirring around with a wooden stick. And then they'd have to get the washing out of that and put it through a press to get the water out of it, and then hang these things on the line. It was a full-time job on a Monday.
Many people will be shocked to hear that the phone was attached to the wall by a cord in those days. Do you remember the new phones that came into the 1960s?
I remember the phone. We didn't get the phone at home that's when I was living at home, for a very long time. But maybe by the 60s we had a phone and would have had...
Sorry, was it that expensive, Nolene, to have a phone in your home in those days?
We had a phone box at the top of the street.
Oh, no need.
Absolutely unnecessary. And who's going to call? Anyway, we did get the phone, and it was quite a nice, attractive Bakelite sort of thing. And it had a little house all to itself in the hall. There was something to sit on and something for the phone book to sit on as well. And then the phone sat on top of that. But then later on, people got phones in the kitchen on the wall. And then there were other super-looking phones from another century yet to come that were available as well in various charming colours.
I remember when one of my earliest memories in life, and this would have been the very late 60s, we had a phone put in at our place. And I can remember my very first phone number. This is in Melbourne, and it was 848-2636. I don't know why the brain creates space to remember such things, but I do remember that. The thing is, that has seven digits in it, I've just realised.
Ours started with LM. LM8816. I find that extraordinary that in your head and mine, you could remember that, even make it important enough to remember. Weird.
Now, among your boyfriends you had in the 1960s, Nolene, was Robert Hughes, the art critic Robert Hughes, the shock of the new, the fatal shore Robert Hughes, that same man?
Yes, before he did those things. But we met in the 50s when we were both about 18 or 19, and we were together for quite some years. I don't talk about him very much because he's the only boyfriend I've ever had that my husband Tony is jealous of.
He was a very handsome man with sort of floppy curly hair.
He was
days,
when he was
he?
Young, yeah, absolutely gorgeous. He could talk, even though he had a bit of a stammer. He was wonderful. You could just sit back and listen to him. He was fabulous.
When you would go out and have a drink in a pub or in a smart nightclub or in a smart bar somewhere like the Marble Bar or something at the Hilton, quite often the drink of choice, perhaps not for you, but for many, was a marvellous sparkling beverage called Porphyry Pearl.
Take a pair of sparkling eyes, take a pair of ruby lips, take a sparkling porphyry pearl.
Serve sparkling porphyry pearl whenever you celebrate. Sparkling porphyry pearl is a quality wine made by Lindemann's, by the champagne method. Buy sparkling porphyry pearl from Metropolitan Bottle Departments for 8 and 6, a large bottle.
8 and 6. I think he was doing a show away from the ABC, that man, don't you?
I think he was playing the Glockenspiel throughout at the same time as well. Porphyry Pearl is a quality wine.
Yes, 8 and 6 for a whole bottle. And it was absolutely vile. I don't know what sort of grapes went into it, but it was so bad I used to drink beer if that's all that was available.
This is Conversations with Richard Feidler on ABC Radio.
Now, this was the era of the cocktail in Australia, which was, an American idea that was brought into Australia. Do you remember drinking smart cocktails?
Many. Yes, and some of them were jumbo cocktails. The jumbo martini appeared in a couple of hostelries. And I don't know, when you're young, you can put them away.
This was the age of what was known as the 6 o'clock swill, where the pubs would close in some states. New South Wales, I think, at 6 o'clock officially. Where on earth did you go for a drink after 6?
Oh, well, you'd have to go somewhere where it was illegal, and there were many of them, and you just ask the cab driver to take you to an illegal club, and he'd go, okay, there you go.
That was it. And how would the alcohol be served? Would it be served openly or surreptitiously?
Well, if you were in a proper restaurant like Vadim's, where we all hung out for years and years, alcohol was served in coffee cups. And then if anybody came in wearing a hat, you'd put the coffee cup under the table because they had white cloths.
Copper? Coppers are here.
Oh, the coppers were certainly checking out everything in Potts Point and King's Cross. Probably making a little money on the side.
Well, that's just it. I think one of the great mistakes you can make when you talk about the 60s, we're talking about really lovely things here, is to portray it as an age of innocence. We were more innocent then. But this was a time of extraordinary police corruption.
Yes, there were too many opportunities for people to be on the take.
This was also a golden era of Australian finger food, Nolene. You can recall certain excellent things. I don't know if I've ever tried these things. I'm not entirely sure what they are. Devils on horseback. What was that?
Now, look, there might be people who say this is not true. I think it's a prune and bacon.
Prune and bacon?
You get your prune, you take your stone out, and then you wrap it in bacon. Now, I think that's what devils in horseback. And there were pigs in blankets.
Pigs in blankets?
Pigs,
what's that?
Pigs in blankets might have been a little sausage, a little weeny sausage wrapped in bread and a toothpick put in. You'd probably then dip it into some sauce, tomato, of course. There were dreadful things. I mean, there were fabulous restaurants coming in. The Italians were opening up fabulous restaurants at that time. But mostly the food, if you read Woman's Weekly or whatever, would be for take a can of this and take a can of that. And I did this myself. My friend Gwenda and I had this recipe. It was for chicken, but we got rabbit. And we got the rabbit and a tin of chicken soup. And we made this thing out of it. We thought it was all right. I mean, we were pretty young. And then I served it. One of the people who was there, one of the guests, nearly died. He had a terrible, like an asthma attack or something. It was Charles Higham. If you recall Charles Higham, the writer, I nearly killed him.
You nearly killed him?
Yeah, and I should have, because he's written all those books where he says, people you like are Nazis.
So who knows what he would have written if you hadn't served him rabbit in chicken soup out of a tin.
But I must say that after that, I learned to cook really well.
What recipes did your mum give you when you left home, Nolene?
Mum was a really good cook, but of course she would have cooked things that most Australians did, like the lamb roast, lamb's fry and bacon, which was one of our faves, a lot of offal. She had another one called Impossible Quiche.
Impossible Quiche,
impossible
what was that?
Quiche, well, you didn't have to make a pastry shell for it. Somehow, magically, the flower in it sort of descended to the bottom and made this sort of case. It actually tasted pretty good. Right. Tasted like a quiche.
Right. The miracle quiche should be by the sound of things as well. Maybe I sometimes think that food in Australia before the war might have been better than after the war because there wasn't the reliance on tinned food so much.
I can hardly remember the war. I was born sort of at the beginning of it, and because my dad, even though he was in the army, didn't go away to serve, so we weren't really touched by it. So I can remember some tanks going past the house, and I can remember going to see a Japanese sub in Sydney Harbour.
Oh, yeah, that's the one that fired off a couple of missiles on the...
It killed people in a ferry.
Yes, that's right. Yeah.
So we went to see that. But that's about it. I remember people in uniform coming to the house and the little old lady next door sobbing when anybody went off to the war. But it really didn't affect us. Remember coupons, but we always had enough. After the war, of course, there was still rationing. So, again, people's health was probably better. You ate a small amount of protein and a lot of vegetables. And everybody knew someone with a farm somewhere where you could get some veggies. A quarter of the plate would be the protein and the three quarters would be veggies.
Some of the stories I tell my own kids that sound preposterous to them. You made photos by shooting them on a camera and then you'd take out the film and then you'd take it to a chemist. What? Why would you take it to a chemist to get it developed? And then the other thing you can tell them is Australia was nowhere near as rich then as it is today, and yet every morning someone would come and put two icy cold bottles of milk on your doorstep in a beautiful glass bottle. Do you remember, though, the only hazard with those things, though, Nolene, was that magpies would come and pierce through the foil tops of them?
They would. Mm. You had to leave money out of there, and occasionally people travelling home late at night might have stolen that money.
You've got a fantastic picture of a new supermarket that had opened in Crow's Nest. This is when the era of the supermarket started to really open right across Australia. And there's a sign on the top that says, no quibbling.
Isn't that gorgeous?
That's gorgeous. Maybe the difference there is that it wasn't like the corner shop where you could sometimes haggle, perhaps. This was the thing. The prices were set and that was it.
I don't remember any haggling in the corner shop at all. I think the price was it. Very proper. I remember going to the little corner shop run by the Goulders, the Goulder family, and everything was in... Now, this is before the 60s, be the late 50s. Everything was in paper bags, big paper bags and Hessian bags on the floor, and you'd shovel some into a paper bag and weigh it, and no haggling there.
That was
you
it.
You just say, thank you, Mr. Goulder.
How were these new supermarkets seen at the time when they arrived? What kind of a radical departure was that?
A lot of people thought that the supermarkets were going to be the end of the corner shop, which we all liked, because we knew the people in the corner shop was a bit like if they'd had a coffee machine, everybody would have gone there for a coffee as well. But they just went there for a talk, for a chat, because quite often women were isolated. They didn't have a car, so they'd go to the corner shop. Everybody thought it was going to change the way we shopped forever, and that's true. That's what's happened.
Australia got its first shopping centres then too, and I think the very first one in Australia was in Brisbane, Chermside, the suburb
of
Chermside.
Yes, it was, yes.
And I remember Doncaster Shopping Town in Melbourne when I was a kid as well. They were seen as faintly glamorous places rather than...
Because they were American, and I think that's what it was. We'd seen them all on film and television, and hey, we've got one ourselves. We copied American style in fashion and music and so on. I think it was just the Americanization of Australia.
This was also an era where mass migration was really starting to have an impact in Australia. You grew up in Marrickville. I lived in Marrickville for a time in Sydney in the early 2000s, and it was very multicultural there. Were you there to sort of sit, watch it change and become less monocultural and more multicultural?
Well, I lived in Stanmore, which was in the Marrickville municipality. It was a wonderful place to live because when we were children, it was just like a little village, a little country town. Everybody was white, English background or Irish, Scottish, but they had chooks and ducks and we played French cricket in the back lanes, and everyone was aware of the kids around them, looked after them. Dangers were always, you know, don't go down the back of the Salisbury Hotel because there's a flag waver about. And
can you explain what a flag waver was?
Don't
please?
You know what a flag waver is? It's someone who exposes themselves.
Like a flasher, you
a
mean?
A flasher.
Right.
Yes, so there was evidently one at the back of the Salisbury, but Gwenda and I never saw one. We'd go up and down that lane.
There were, I thought flashers were invented in the 1970s. Shows how naive I am, doesn't it? So you were introduced suddenly to all this new food and coffee that was coming around. How keen were you to try the new stuff?
Right. Well, it used to drive us nuts on, you know, the weekends. We'd smell all this wonderful stuff cooking on barbecues outside, blistering peppers and eggplant and lamb with, you know, you could smell rosemary and lemon and, oh, wow, it smelt so good. So occasionally we would swap a few things. We'd get figs from one of our neighbours and Mum would give them some chocos.
Chocos.
Yes. Yeah, fair swap.
You bring us your cup. You, please sample one of our splendid chocos. Lovely. Music was rapidly evolving, of course. I don't know if it really caught on. Like in the mid-60s, we had the Easy Beats and the VGs, who then pretty quickly went to the UK. It sounds like you were more of a jazz person in the 1960s than a rock and roll person.
I was a real snob about music. Uh-huh. I liked jazz and poetry, and they often went together. And you'd go to a club and there'd be a lot of smoking going on. Can't really, I think it was just coffee, but smoking and really earnest poetry and
so this is a kind
music.
Of a beatnik scene, was it?
Yeah, it was quite early, yep.
You did see the Rolling Stones in a bar one.
I did see the Rolling Stones at the Hilton, no longer there. The Hilton had a lovely little bar. We used to go for martinis because nothing could be more international than a martini.
You felt very smart.
Very smart, yes. I remember going in there on the night that I saw the Rolling Stones, and I was wearing olive green, so I had my martini with an olive because it went with what I was wearing.
You can wear clothes that matched your drink garnish.
Why not? Anyway, they came in. Mick and his mates were skinny little undernourished people with bad accents. You know, I'm a real snob by now. So I looked down the end to see what they were drinking. They were drinking bourbon and Coke, which I thought was a shocking drink. You know, I still do. So I didn't feel I should go up there and hang around for a selfie or anything.
It was more common for women to make their own clothes back in those days. Did you make your own clothes, Noel?
My mum was a terrific, really good seamstress, and she helped me make stuff. But occasionally, because by then we were wearing the simple shift, we'd thrown away our undergarments. Well, we kept our knickers on, but you didn't have to wear things like roll-ons and step-ins and, you know, elasticised things.
I don't know what these things are. What's a roll-on and a step-in?
Well, have a look at the footballers, and they wear them now.
Right.
Underneath their shorts.
Right.
To keep everything nice and firm.
To keep everything strapped down.
That's right, yes. But we used to wear them whether we needed them or not. So when the shift came in, this simple dress with no sort of waist thing, we didn't have to wear all that stuff. So I could run up a dress on Mum's faithful Singer sewing machine in half a day.
Was the shift a dress that was introduced by Jean Shrimpton at the Melbourne Cup?
She made it famous because that was such a very elegant, simple dress that got her into so much trouble. I can't believe it. But mainly the reason she got into trouble was she was not wearing a hat. That was about the worst thing you could do in Melbourne in those days, evidently, is not wear a hat. And there were no matching hat and gloves. And that's a terrible sin in those days.
In the 1960s is when Australia shifted from the old currency, the pounds, shillings and pence, to the new decimal currency, the dollars and cents. And there was this kind of ad campaign. And anyone who was around at this time still remembers this jingle.
In come the dollars, in come the cents, to replace the pound and the shillings and the pence. Be prepared, folks, when the coins begin to mix on the 14th of February 1966.
Dollar Bill, that was the name of the cartoon.
Yeah,
character.
I don't know who did the voice for that.
Yeah, but if you mention it today, most people will burst into song. They've it's somehow tattooed onto their memory, that little jingle.
Well, they played it all the time.
Now, is it true that Robert Menzies, who was the Prime Minister at the time, wanted to have the new currency called the dollar, but the royal?
Well, there was a big controversy about calling it the dollar because that was a bit American, but he did evidently say we should call it the royal, and other people said maybe we should call it the Ming. Maybe they were being funny, but there were all sorts of ideas for the name of the currency, but we went with the dollar.
Did people complain or did they just sort of get on with it?
Oh, they complained. It was a bit like daylight saving because it was going to, you know, bleach the curtains. But no, they did complain. I remember somebody ringing up and saying to an announcer, why can't they just wait for all the old people to die?
And then once we have no more old people,
then they can get on with Dollar Bill.
Australia goes to the polls to elect the 26th Parliament, and the main issue is conscription for Vietnam. Opposition leader Colwell has declared he will withdraw Australian troops if Labor is elected. Prime Minister Harold Holt has said Australia must stay in Vietnam alongside the United States and is confident that most people agree with his policy. The result is the biggest vote of confidence any Prime Minister has ever received. The swing towards the government staggers the Labor Party.
How political were you in those days throughout the 1960s? Because the currents picked up very quickly as Australia became a participant in the Vietnam War and then introduced conscription for young Australian men to be brought over there to fight.
Well, that's the thing that most of us got political over, that particular issue, because it was us, it was our friends and brothers, and it was, you know, just too appalling. So I don't know anyone who wasn't political at that time. You know, I feel my mates and I had a hand in it. You know, voting is a very important thing, and it's a wonderful privilege to be able to go there and change. And there's still anger about it from returned Vietnam vets because they had paint thrown over them and, you know, baby killers and all of that stuff said to them. But in most cases, we were trying to save them. We weren't trying to criticise them at all.
The Labor Party was changing rapidly in the 1960s. There was, you came from an old Labor family, like you said,
yeah.
And that would have been part of that old Labor Party of the going out right up to the war years, which was, you know, very working class in origin, quite close to the Catholic Church for a while,
yeah.
But also quite conservative in social matters and supportive of the White Australia policy. But on the other hand, there were new figures coming up into the Labor Party who were tertiary educated, like Gough Whitlam and Don Dunstan in South Australia. What did you make of those that change in the Labor Party at the time, Nolene?
Well, I could certainly see that there were changes even without them. I could see a new Labor man coming on, and it was Gough. I think Gough was the one person who could actually change the Labor Party, bring it into the new century and attract younger people, because it was a bit of an old codgers club for a while. So I wanted to support Gough. I thought he had good intentions.
One of the most telling things in the TV series Mad Men, which covers all 10 years of the 1960s, ends up in 1970. And about halfway through, or it's around about 66 that year, Don Draper, the character, the ad man, his wife's bought a Beatles album. I think she's got Revolver. And he's listening to one of the tracks. And he doesn't say as much, but it's kind of on his face that the culture's going so fast. It's gone right past him in a way. He's not keeping up with it. At the beginning of the 60s, he's there. He's the kind of the guy in the sharp suit, the Kennedy era guy. He's like, you know, Dean Martin and Frank Sinatra, that ring-a-ding-ding culture was hit in the 1960s. But the culture's run right past him, and he hasn't been able to keep up with it. Did you have a sense of that, the sense of the culture moving really quickly throughout the 1960s?
Well, I appreciated the movement. I think in the case of the character in Mad Men, he was seeing his relevance disappear. And I could see other opportunities coming, because there were things that we wouldn't have dreamt of doing at the beginning of the 60s that we were able to do at the end. the way we revolted against things, and we could see that was going to change things. We felt, as young people, we were part of change.
Does that Australia look like another country now to you, the Australia of the 1960s?
At the beginning, it's like 200 years ago. It seems as long ago as that. At the end of the decade, it was quite bizarre because everyone sort of took holidays. I mean, it was unreal. And I suppose there was the hippie drug culture, and I was certainly around that, a weekend hippie. So that was weird, but it didn't really continue because we'd all be dead, I think.
You said it's the most important decade in your life. Why? Why do you think it was the most important decade?
Because I did so much in that time. I went from a job in the public service to becoming a face on television that everybody recognised. But apart from that, I was able to do work that I really, really loved doing. I thought, here's a career possibly for life. That was really important. I went out into the world as a young woman on my own. I didn't marry and settle down. Not that there's anything wrong with that. I did it eventually, married for 41 years, but I waited till I was 37 to do that. Absolutely middle-aged. But it was first time overseas, flew overseas, didn't go on a ship like everybody else. So there were lots of things that I just felt. I'm grateful that I had those opportunities in the 60s.
What a beautiful book it is. What amazing pictures you've managed to put together with the help of the National Library in there as well. And it's been so lovely having you back, Nolene. Thank you so much.
And it weighs a kilo.
Yeah, listen to this. You can stun a burglar with that, can't you? With that bang like that. Thank you so much, Nolene.
Lovely to see you.
abc.net.au/conversations is our website. I'm Richard Feidler.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Richard Feidler. For more Conversations interviews, please go to the website abc.net.au/conversations.